Coming to you live from an old-timey speakeasy, I'm Tom Rich, and with me as always is a never-ending sea of baffling slang, and this is the Mildly Alarming Podcast. Episode 37, How to Grow Out Your Back Hair for Fun and Profit.
Welcome back to the Mildly Alarming Podcast. I'm Johannes Stauffer.
And I'm Tom Rich.
That's all I have planned.
It's the end of the show. Good night, everybody. But we're back, we're here, we're on the Mildly Alarming Podcast. We're glad to have y'all boys up ins and girls and others. However you identify is fine by us. We are inclusive as shit.
Good lord.
But we're glad to have you here.
Might be a new record, by the way, for least time into the episode before we've had to add in a farm animal noise.
Oh, we can do better.
Oh, I think we can, but I don't think we have.
Oh, that's fair. Okay. But anyway, tonight's topic is tabletop RPGs versus board games. The rumble in the basement.
Library.
Yeah.
Middle of the food court.
With a circle of empty tables around you because nobody wants to be near that business.
Or the smell emanating, or the lingering cloud of Cheeto dust.
It's just all Cheeto dust all the time.
It gets on everything.
You know, we're really self-hating nerds, aren't we?
Yeah, yeah. So the reason we're talking about differences between tabletop RPGs and more traditional fits-in-a-box kind of board games is because we, and by we, I mean mostly Tom, have been working on our own pen and paper RPG called Hero. And we had a playtest for the first time
two nights ago.
Right. Today is Tuesday.
Which is, it's called that because it's the second weekday of the week. Tuesday, like two, the number.
Sure.
That's why one day, because Monday used to be one day, but they just sort of gradually got that M on the front of it.
They just got it. It just sort of
worked its way in.
Just like the number one has gradually over time morphed to the word mun.
Yeah.
So mun to we.
Wednes. Sir. Frive.
Okay, I see your point.
Yeah,
I see your point.
It's a solid theory. Linguists, call me. Numerologists, call me. But anyway, yeah, we did a play test for our game Hero on Sunday to see if the basic die mechanics worked and if we were accomplishing what we were going for. And we learned some things from it. So Hero's idea, for those not in the know, which is probably all of you, was that we wanted a light pen and paper RPG that would kind of get like a Legend of Zelda type feel to it. It would play relatively quickly and it would allow for rotation of roles among the players. So rather than having one player act as the dungeon master or game master for the entire campaign over stretching over many sessions, you might rotate that job among everybody. Two, it would also include one character in each adventure designated the hero whose story you were telling and who was the main character, and everybody else would play supporting characters whose stories tie into that main story. So we were trying to kind of work the narrative into the rule structure a little bit, see if we couldn't maybe keep the body guessing to some degree. And we ran into some stuff. We learned some good stuff about the die mechanics. I don't want to delve too much into the weeds of the specific rules system we were working on here, because that's probably pretty boring for people who aren't me.
Plus, it's all going to change in the next week anyway.
Yeah, and who aren't up to their neck beards in my spreadsheets. You see what I did there?
Spreadsheets or neck beards? Because like, there's a lot of ways that you could go with that joke.
Hey. But anyway, so what I mean, I guess what we could talk about here is, we could talk about a lot of things, but where do you see like a tabletop RPG, like a Dungeons and Dragons or a Vampire the Masquerade or a that's those are the two I can think of off the top of my head. Different, like
Shadowrun,
yeah, that kind of thing.
D20 Modern.
Fine, show me up. Where do you see them diverging from your game in a from your all comes in one box type of board games that we've talked about and we design mostly?
Well, I think from a, I don't know about intent, maybe intent. Definitely among the people who play them, generally you're looking for more. First of all, role playing. Mm-hmm. There's not a real requirement for role playing in most board games, mm-hmm. and I guess you can get by in a lot of tabletop RPGs without ever really role playing either. But that is sort of the point.
But if you don't get to pretend to be an elf, why bother?
Right.
Frankly, I ask myself that with everything I do.
Which is why he carries a pair of pointy adhesive ear tips in his pockets at all times in case the opportunity arises to put them on
and he can pretend to be an elf. Yeah.
Sneak up behind him at work in his cube sometime. He's probably got.
I have my. Oh, I put them on right when I get to work every morning.
Yeah. Well, I've completely lost track of what I was saying. No, it's also a lot more open. Generally speaking, a tabletop RPG allows for any number of things to happen, and the rules exist almost less to be a set of rules to constrain what you can do, but more a framework to tell you what you are allowed to do that both the players and the game master can build on.
Yeah, it's like in a board game, the rules exist to firmly delineate what is possible. In a tabletop RPG, they exist to resolve a dispute when you don't agree with about what happens, kind of.
Yeah.
Because like the only real reason you need dice and paper and pens and all that is because you want to fairly figure out if you killed that orc or not with your spear of orc killing.
Right.
Plus
one.
Plus, yeah, it's not that great, but
right.
But you get an extra D6 against orcs, so that's not bad.
Yeah,
but so you know, like in a board game, you would have to strictly delineate here is how you fight. In a tabletop RPG, the only reason you have that structure is because you need something to adjudicate it. If you can role play your way through the fight without ever having to roll any dice, that works.
Yeah,
you know, or if you can come up with a clever way of going about it that doesn't require the rolling of dice, the game lets you do that.
Part of what we run into in trying to build our own tabletop RPG is there's a lot more adjudicating to be done than you might think.
Yeah, your dice system, whatever you come up with, has to be able to handle an enormous variety of circumstances.
And then it's very hard to balance that. And so that's why games like Dungeons & Dragons offer these enormous compendiums of pre-existing items and magic devices and bad guys and stuff that they know, within reason, work with one another at given character levels and stuff.
Right, right.
So you don't have to be constantly running your own spreadsheets trying to make sure that the baddies that you're throwing at your party as a game master aren't going to completely annihilate them, or that the magical weapon that you gave them when they finished their last quest isn't going to make them so unstoppably overpowered that nothing you can throw at them is a challenge anymore.
Right. The flip side is that even with, you know, a game like D&D, you know, 3.5 edition, which was developed over many years, evolved, it had, you know, probably one of the most complete rule sets you could think of.
Yeah.
Just covered all of the ground. There was still stuff that just flat out bumped into each other, didn't work,
yeah,
broke the game. So there's always an element of you and your playgroup in a tabletop RPG kind of settling on, this is the kind of game we want to play. So, like, just don't be the guy who brings something that doesn't work in that kind of game to the table. Just don't do that.
Yeah.
Don't be that guy. Like, if we're trying to play a game that's like a detective story, don't just stab everyone we see. Just don't bring a character that's not going to fit in the detective story.
Yeah.
If we're trying to do just a classic kick in the door type adventure where we're just grabbing loot and killing goblins, don't bring a character that's going to constantly, you know, betray the party and wreak havoc and keep us from moving forward and kicking in more doors.
Right.
If we're playing low powered here, we're not all min-maxing our characters until they're the end-all, be-all ruiner of worlds. Don't being the end-all, be-all ruiner of worlds character, because just, man, don't be that guy.
Right, and there's a lot more in, because it's so open-ended, there's a lot more of having to trust your fellow players to not be that guy. Than you find in board games. So again, you see the restrictions in board games working in a lot of cases to keep people from falling too far down mm-hmm. the hole of any of the number of player types that we've talked about, where mm-hmm. any given Dungeons & Dragons campaign really allows for someone to be the shameless min-maxer, someone to be the rules lawyer, someone to be the, you know, cardboard quarterback, and everyone can do that as long as the party doesn't, like, allows them to.
Right, right.
There's not a lot in the game mechanics itself to stop that. So there's a lot more on the players to work together to make the game work
mm-hmm.
In a tabletop than in a board game, more typical board game
yeah.
box. I think a lot of what you see, it's a big difference between a board game and a RPG is that the time commitment.
Mm-hmm.
A definitely. Board game is generally going to be we're going to sit down and play this to the end.
Yeah.
And obviously there are games that don't work that way where they're like, you're going to sit down and play the first mission of the campaign or yeah. whatever, and you're going to come back 8 more times before this is actually done with, or you're going to get sick of it after the second one.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, I was seeing a reflection.
Oh, like, gotcha.
What am I?
There's a guy in a hockey mask in the recording studio right now, and he's waving a machete around. So we're not real worried about it right now because he's like all the way over there, but we'll keep you guys posted. Anyway, yeah. Continue.
I forget. Time commitment. Is
yeah.
that what I was talking about?
Time commit, yeah. Yeah, so a board game is going to be one... Typically, you can complete a chunk of it in one sitting.
Yeah.
Usually, you can complete the whole thing in one sitting, but if anything, it's going to be divided into things you can do in one go.
Right.
Whereas a tabletop RPG can be pretty open-ended. It's like, how long you got to play? Because we can keep going.
Yeah, what do we play for normally? When we were playing in high school, four hours?
Yeah, it was a 4-hour schedule, at yeah. any rate. And then sometimes it went long, and that went for years.
Yeah.
It was fun.
It was fun. So, and sometimes we didn't complete... Sometimes we blew away what Tom had planned for us in the first 5 minutes because we went in a completely different direction than he expected, and it just didn't work out, and he had to fly by the seat of his pants. Sometimes he'd have a whole dungeon planned mm-hmm. for us, and by the time 4 hours were up and we were all too far gone to really continue interacting with the game in a meaningful way, the hockey mask guy keeps trying to get my attention
mm-hmm.
and it's distracting.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we would be, you know, a third of the way through a dungeon that he had planned for us to finish that night and just have to say, well, we're going to call it when we get to the end of this combat or whatever, because
right.
otherwise we're going to be here until we die. So I feel like you need a lot more attention span, and you need more free time in your schedule to be
yeah,
like, I'm going to go somewhere for 4.5 hours
and play,
tonight.
I'm going to play me some Dungeons and Dragons.
Right.
Yeah. One of the things I found in that playtest for Hero that was kind of interesting to me is that what you write down on the sheet for a player, or what you put into the rules kind of works to circumscribe what they're going to do. Like, people are going to look at what they have written on their sheet and think that's what's possible to some uh-huh. degree. Like, if you don't see a thing there, it's going to be like, well, I don't... Because, like, I can remember somebody wanted to try to sneak past a guard,
uh-huh.
and I didn't have a skill specifically labeled sneak.
For sneak.
And so I think somebody asked, you know, do you have stealth in yonder game
uh-huh.
that you have made? And I'm like, yeah, just use the other skill, because I forgot about stealth instead. And so, like, that's a thing. Like, you need to make sure that you have in some way sculpted out the things people are commonly going to ask about.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, even if you try to play it fast and loose with how something works, like, you've really got to think about how your players are going to take it. Because I had that magic power one guy's character had, Devin's character did.
Mm-hmm.
He could speak the words of power and have very open-ended, broad strokes impact on the world around him, and he just sort of didn't use it because I was so broad in what he could do that he didn't have anything he could latch on to try
right.
to execute on it. So it's this weird balancing act between giving people enough information that they can climb up the wall of your game and use it, but not so much that they feel like I can only do this one thing with it.
Or even enough information that they can figure out how to literally climb up a wall in your game. Versus
yeah.
being like, so again, go back to Dungeons & Dragons has a climb check.
Right.
You can have ranks in climb. Climb is a skill. And in Hero, we used...
It was athletics.
Athletics, which, I mean, it makes sense. But there were no additional bonuses to it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, depending on how a game was put together, you could end up with something that had a clear delineation. I don't think we ran across this in the hero playtest, but you could end up with, especially just using different terminology, you could have strength and athletics as both being attributes. And then you go, well, which one do I use to climb this wall? Because you could make the argument athletics is, you know, endurance and running or acrobatics or something like that.
Right.
Strength is just brute, you know, lift a thing off the ground. So you got to be careful in being clear in your word choices and your stat choices and just so many things. And when you've got people coming from experience with other board games and other RPGs, mm-hmm. which is the big problem we ran into with Hero.
Yeah.
There was so much we were like, well, in Dungeons and Dragons, I know exactly what I would do here. And we would start proceeding that way. And then sometimes it would work out. And sometimes we'd stop and go, wait, how do we do this? Can we do this?
Right. Well, I feel like, too, in a tabletop RPG, people or at least in this playtest, it seemed like people were translating over knowledge from other games more than they do in a board game.
Yeah.
Like in a board game, it's kind of assumed you've now entered an entirely new system. You got to learn the ropes of that system. Whereas with the tabletop, there was just a lot of D&D that came over almost unconsciously with folks.
Yeah.
And part of that, I think, is that with a board game, you get, you know, a 10-minute, 15, 20-minute rules explanation dump at the start every time. And you've got a lot of rules printed on the cards. You probably have the rule book. You could pass it around if you wanted to.
Right.
Whereas in a RPG, often only one or two players has the rule book. In the case of Hero, the rule book mostly existed in my head.
Right.
So, I mean, no, it was written down, but, you know, only it wasn't as advanced a thing or as universal a thing. That didn't help matters.
So as the one who did the bulk of the designing of the game, and kind of, I guess it bears mentioning the way Hero runs, the game master, as we mentioned, can rotate the ideas that, you know, for one evening of play or whatever, you'll have a hero, some supporting characters, and a game master who's really not so much running the game, but the word we were throwing around for that position is the villain.
Mm-hmm.
The idea being that, say, you're going through a dungeon, the villain has a dice pool and some stuff to choose from, and maybe gets to design or choose from a list of pre-designed dungeons or whatever to pit against the party. And it allows for a more adversarial role. So sometimes you'll see a not very good game master who treats the party like the enemy, and because the game master is virtually all powerful, that can be a problem. And we wanted to sort of create a space where the game master wasn't truly game master. They weren't all powerful. They were just basically playing the monsters in the dungeon against the party. So they could be adversarial because they're limited in their own dice pool and things available to them. So I don't think we hit that point because you were truly game mastering because you were the only one who really understood the game. So you were teaching it and running it and answering
and
questions.
I think that we're going to wind up falling a little bit more on the game's mastery side of things than we intended, if only because of the nature of a tabletop RPG.
Uh-huh.
Like, you just need somebody at the table whose job it is to say, no, we use this rule in this situation.
Right.
You need that judge role to some degree.
Right.
Unfortunately.
Well, so I have two questions. One about the playtest, which is how did you feel like it went from the game master side? And the other question I'm going to say now before I forget it, is basically the heart of the issue that we're coming up against with Hero is that there's no middle ground really between board games and RPG tabletops. There's this sort of void in between where if you start to cross the line too much on either side, you either end up with a unplayably restrictive RPG or a board game that's too open-ended and just needs rules clarifications. And I think what we wanted to make would live somewhere in the middle. So the question is that even possible?
My gut reaction is to say no, but no, because I've been friends with you for 20 years and I'm a pessimist now, but you've trained me well.
My plan is working.
But I know it's got to be possible. Like, there's got to be a way to hit that sweet spot. It might not be everybody's cup of tea.
Yeah.
And it might be a game that requires a lot of upfront, look, this is the nature of what we've designed. You got to get on board if it's going to work. But if you do, it will be fun.
Right.
But I think we can hit it with work. It's going to take a lot of playtesting and a lot of hammering, but I think it's definitely possible.
Okay.
To go back to what I got from it as a games master, I had underprepared on what I needed on my side of the table to do what I did, what I needed to do. I needed more information about my monsters. I needed to format it better so that I wasn't going to my notes quite so much. So that was, I didn't have the stat blocks down.
Sure.
In terms of making them easy to use. But in terms of running the game, it actually, and this is going to sound a little bit weird probably, it was actually in some ways easier than a D&D campaign would have been.
Sure.
In that, and part of this was that because it was the playtest, I was being super on rails about it. Like, I wasn't going to let you guys get off track. I was going to be like, no, this happens now.
Yeah.
Yeah. But part of it, too, was that there were fewer moving parts for me to set and fewer... And the die roll systems we designed were a little bit more consistent. Like, the thing that is doing something always rolls the dice.
Mm-hmm.
So you never have a defensive roll. You never have a saving throw to roll when something attacks you. It's always, if you want to do something to somebody, you roll.
Mm-hmm.
So that consistency, you know, helps keep some stuff straight in mind. If I want to poison you guys, I'm like, oh, I just roll my dice and see if I poison somebody.
Right.
It's not make a save against this number that I then have to look up. Similarly, the system has a curtailed range of usable numbers compared to D20 systems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're never going to go anywhere higher than 12.
Right.
So that kind of narrows down what you have to think about as a games master a little bit. I felt like the combat flows a little smoother than D&D's because everybody declares their action at the beginning of a round. And then rolls, and then you work your way through initiative from there.
Mm-hmm.
So the actions are already decided. The players just have to see how they work out.
It's almost like a programming thing.
It's
kind of like
a little bit
the planning and then resolution in
right
a programming game. What's the one?
Space Alert.
Space Alert.
The one we always use as the example of programming games
because it's the one we've played.
Right. So absolutely. So it kind of short circuited the problem you have in D&D and other RPGs where, you know, you're working your way through a very lengthy involved comment and you get to one player's turn and he's wandered away to go get some chips and you get to the next player's turn and they're on their phone and they haven't thought about their action. It also just takes an eternity.
Yeah.
So as a games master, there were a couple of things that I liked. I'm like, this makes my job better and it seems to make it more fun for me.
Yeah. Well, and ideally, if we can get the villain role working as we would like, the games master wouldn't be in a games master role even for combat.
You would
just be like, I know the stats of the monsters and you know the stats of yourselves and we'll see how this works out.
We'll see how it plays.
How our dice roll.
Yeah. Yeah. So as a player, was there anything that stood out to you?
The things we mentioned where it was so open that it stood to go on forever, but the game didn't have the guts in place to handle it. If we had chosen to go search for a different door into the structure than the one that you intended, that kind of thing. So eventually you were like, okay, no, you open the door. The door's open. It opened. It didn't make any noise. You didn't have to worry about a trap and it wasn't going to squeak, which is all the like playing campaigns, particularly playing D&D campaigns run by Tom, just looking forever and always for weird, obnoxious traps and ways around them. It was something we just didn't need to do there. And it would have been much faster, and we probably could have replayed the whole campaign a second time if we were a bunch of playtesters who had never played a campaign that you've run.
Mm-hmm.
If I wasn't there being like, but wait a second, the scree-covered slope, are we going to slip down it and die?
Right.
It could have gone very quickly.
So much could have changed if I hadn't used the phrase scree-covered.
And at some point you used the phrase on rails and that kind of clicked in my mind. I was like, I guess really that's, I think, where we could hit that midpoint between RPGs and tabletops is, say you have a monster manual. It doesn't have to be a monster manual the size of the one in Dungeons and Dragons. But I mean, if you were to really take the game and make it, for starters, just make it Zelda. find all of the bad guys that exist in Zelda. There are a fair number of them, but enough that would fit in a reasonably small book. And they're always the same.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
you're fighting a Moblin.
Or a like, or whatever. They take X number of hits to kill.
Yep. Yep.
I mean, and like X number of damage because you can upgrade your sword over the course of the game. But really, like, the math is really simple. And then now you say, okay, Hero and, like, maybe, you know, Hero has the very limited amount of gear available to them. Maybe supporting characters don't have gear available to them at all. They just have a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're a supporting character, you just are what you are. And villain, you have, to some degree, the ability to make traps and puzzles and use these monsters, you know, based on the level of the hero. You can't throw a way later monster at him because he's not ready for it yet. And now you've basically got Zelda the tabletop, but it runs pretty straightforward. And like in the game design, in the dungeon design, you could literally put it on rails. I mean, you could do a minecart, but you could say where we would be like, we're going to search for another, mm-hmm. another way around. You could just be like, well, you can't. Right. There are walls. There are literally walls. There isn't another way around. This is a naturally occurring hallway leading to that door because the cliff walls are 1,000 feet high, mm-hmm. and sheer, tough. Go through the door. Like, you could get there. That's what I started thinking about. And I was really thinking about it. So we got, it was a very short mission in planning. Mm-hmm. In execution, we took far longer than we needed to. Like, we scaled a cliff, we opened a door, we fought some dudes, we went down a staircase, we fought the boss, the end.
The boss was the giant three-headed dog.
I was looking for, you know, okay, we're going to fight these guys in the courtyard if we can't sneak past them. We're going to go down the stairs, and there's going to be, like, a layer of puzzles and dungeon before we get mm-hmm. to a boss. And so when we got to the boss, I was like, oh, there's the boss. I guess we're not. So my brain was going off on what I didn't realize was a tangent, planning for dungeon mazes that never happened. Sure. But I still think it could work. I still think it could straddle the two worlds of RPG
mm-hmm.
and board game. I think we could get there.
We could get there. We're just going to need some supporting characters to help our hero out.
I think my biggest, like, grand scheme realization here was that we set out to, and we're like, well, maybe we could do a tabletop, a pen and paper, because your cousin, the Bully Pulpit Games guy?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Has a pen and paper RPG that he made that has, like, a 3 or 4 page manual.
It's incredibly short.
And we're sitting there going, thinking like, oh, that's really simple. Like, you could do something like that. In reality, that's probably monumentally complex
mm-hmm.
to run. Like, that's a great little starter RPG for someone with no experience with RPGs.
Mm-hmm.
But if you bring a party of us, of veteran D&Ders,
right.
or maybe not even veteran. I know there are people with much more experience than I have, mm-hmm. but bring people with our hang-ups and our, like, everything is Dungeons and Dragons, or everything is somehow drawing on my previous experiences, to something that open-ended,
right.
That could become a nightmare for the person right. running it.
Because you have to be able to adapt to those simple rule systems and figure out how to layer them on top of the weird that the players are trying to do now.
Exactly. So the simpler your game design in RPG, it almost seems like the more complex the actual gameplay becomes.
Yeah, it depends on how it depends a little bit on how well you can buffalo your players in terms of the players in terms of them thinking, oh, this guy totally knows what he's doing.
You're especially like, if your players are buffalo.
Right. If you're playing with buffalo, that we don't have time for that. You're right, though. You're right. Simple rule sets can hide a very complex running of the game and require an experienced DM or GM to kind of make it work. So hopefully ours will work. It won't. It's going to be terrible.
It's entirely possible. A friend of mine who is actually the son of one of our high school teachers, one of the ones we liked,
mm-hmm.
Has a podcast about tabletop RPGs.
We should interview that person on
our show. Yeah, I want to see if I can get him on our show, and he's got his own podcast mm-hmm. in addition to playing lot.
We can pimp his podcast.
Yeah, I'm blanking on what it's called. It's something about, what are you spinning? So they talk about Drink Spin Run. Adam Miskevich, Drink Spin Run, an RPG talk show podcast at drinkspinrun.com. They talk about what are you drinking? So they'll have a guest on or a couple of guests.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe the first interview is that they do two shows with a given guest or set of guests. And the first one is usually, what are you drinking? What are you spinning? What are you running? So drinking, booze, spinning, what music are you listening to? Running, mm-hmm. what RPGs are you doing right now? Or what games are you into? And then I think the second one, they talk about a specific topic with this person. And then they also do like a once or twice a month live play of an RPG.
Sweet.
So I've listened to a few of them. They're pretty entertaining. Some of it went over my head. Like, he's into some way, way more obscure RPGs than I've ever even heard of, let alone attempted to play.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to get his feedback on our game, and it would be cool to get him on the show.
Yeah, it'd be a lot of fun. We should do it. So, Drink Spin Run guy, if you are listening to our show, hit us up. We'll talk. We'll have our people call your people. We don't have people.
We are arguably people. Anyway, if you are the Drink Spin Run guy and you don't know how to get a hold of us because this is somehow the first one of our these that you've listened to just by fate, here's how. On Twitter at Mildly Alarming.
You can do it on Gmail mail emails at you can hold on. You just gotta send the letter, but it's in bits and bytes, and the address is mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com.
Holy crap. You could post a comment in the comment section on the website at www.mildlyalarming.com. You can also find us on facebook.com/mildlyalarmingshow. And we'll go into all the other fun things at the end of the second segment. Are there any other ways that they can contact us involving bats or hair?
Well, if you roll a nat 20, you contact us automatically.
That's true. Yeah. All right. No bats or hair necessary.
So just keep on rolling.
We'll be right back after this word from our sponsors. Rolling.
Come on, kid. This is a Mildly Alarming Radio News Breaking News Break. I'm Reginald St. Kevin.
And I'm Chep Holstein. Good evening. In national news, the presidential race continues to play out as the political equivalent of a portly child intent on his fudge ripple ice cream cone, failing to spot a curb, and falling off of his bicycle. Hilarious, and yet likely a harbinger of far sadder things to come.
And in international news, the English are still around doing their thing. Reached for comment, they referred to a reporter as a wee fack shiter and advised him to pike off.
Haha, Reg, what will they think of next? In sports, a grown man who was paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to tell meat-noggin youngsters how to throw balls got super mad and broke a clipboard over one of their heads. Allegedly, the thick-witted sports guy had failed to put the ball where the windbreaker and khaki-bedecked man-child wanted it when he wanted it. Reach for comment, the tremendously overpaid failure of a human being blubbered like the giant, stupid baby that he is before retiring to the mansion which compensates for his receding hairline, beer gut, and fractured sense of masculine purpose.
In local news, a dog spoke with the voice of a man.
And in the weather, it's nothing but creamed corn through the weekend, followed by a lightly braised meat sorbet.
This has been your Mildly Alarming Radio News Breaking News Break. I'm Reginald St. Kevin.
And I'm Lionel Palpudi.
I thought you were Chep Holstein.
Oh, right. We now return you to your regularly scheduled program.
Welcome back to the Mildly Alarming Podcast. I'm Tom Rich.
And I'm Biff Cleverly. I just made up a name right off the top of my head there.
Can you be Johannes Stauffer for this segment? Because, like, I don't get paid if he's not here.
You get paid? I'm Johannes Stauffer, but we're splitting that from here on out.
Damn it. It's not much. It's a penny.
That's so much more money than I make for this.
But welcome back. We're glad to have you. Glad you're here. Glad you returned after whatever happened on the commercial break. We don't get to know until the podcast goes live. The ad network just slots it in and it just happens. So we don't know what you just listened to. What are we talking about tonight, Giannis?
Bookkeeping.
So it's really important in life that you keep track of your incomes and expenses and make sure the latter doesn't exceed the former. And bookkeeping is a common term for that, in both in business and pleasure. So you really need to get a set of books and just write down all the money you spend and all the money you get. And if they start to get out of balance, make you fix that.
I'm sorry, Tom. No, this segment is actually it may be an out of use, somewhat antiquated term, but it's actually about like libraries, the keeping of books.
Oh,
you didn't do any research, did you?
No, you got to put them on shelves and dust them now and again.
Yeah,
and like spray them for worms. Make sure the worms don't get in there. That's what you got to do when you keep books.
I actually heard some pretty interesting stuff about books and the keeping thereof. Because printed and bound books were so rare and expensive for so long, libraries had them. They didn't have shelves. Like, shelves, in comparison to bound books, are a modern invention.
Weird.
Because they were so valuable, they were chained to the desk. And so people couldn't take them. You had to go read them. And so they had to have a way to put a metal ring through them, basically. And it wasn't until, I forget how much later, I want to say this was on the Good Job Brain podcast that I heard about this. But like they finally started having enough of them that they put them on shelves, but they still shelved them really oddly. And so the now standard of putting the title and the author on the spine was like, why would you put anything on the spine? Because even when they started shelving them, they would like stack them on top of each other instead of on end. So it was really inefficient because books might be different sizes.
Right.
And the spine was always still in because they were still chained to something. And so having the author and title on the spine of the book came much, much later when they started stacking books next to one another on end with the spine facing out.
Huh.
History. That's not actually the kind of bookkeeping that we're talking about, though. That was a long and drawn out joke.
This is an amazing podcast.
It's something. Yeah.
So we're thinking about bookkeeping. Games board in particular ask you to keep track of a lot of information. For example, in what is the game I'm thinking of? It's on the tip of my tongue.
Is it Eclipse? That's the one I always forget the name of.
Yeah, sure, we'll go with that one. So, like, Eclipse is asking you to keep track of what planets you've got control over, you know, three different types of resources, your fleets and their positions, all sorts of stuff.
I think that's the one that we play regularly that has the most ridiculous
stuff.
Number of stats and resources to keep track of.
Yeah, but even a comparatively simple game like Arkham. No, Arkham is a bad example.
No, it's a terrible
example. Wrong thing. It wasn't what I was thinking of at all. Puerto Rico is the one I'm thinking of, which you didn't get to play because you'd left by that point. And it isn't even that simple. I don't know. I don't know what the game is. There's a game that requires bookkeeping, but it's just not happening tonight. You have to keep track of information in games.
True.
I guess kind of what we're wondering is if there are games that have particularly good methods of tracking all of this stuff you have to watch out for over the course of the game. If there are methods that work out well as reminders, as ways of keeping the player reminded of what they have or informed of what they have or need to know, and if there are games that do it well or badly. That's kind of what we're thinking with when we talk about bookkeeping. So, for instance, Eclipse asks you to keep track of how much you get per turn of three different resources, and you have different planets throughout the galaxy that will produce them, and you may or may not control them, and you've got to move stuff around. But it does that fairly effectively, because when you gain control of a planet that produces a particular resource, you just take a cube off of your row for that resource and put it on the planet, and now the newly vacated space that was under that cube tells you how much you produce now.
Right.
So there's a nice kind of connection between now you gained control of a thing that gives you this resource. The act of gaining control of it tells you how much you have now.
Right.
So that's the kind of bookkeeping I think of as good, because you don't have to do an extra step to do it.
Right. On the one hand, it's a lot of stuff to keep track of, different types of resources and how they come and go. in your empire. But on the other hand, if you walk away from the board to use the bathroom or whatever and forget, you can come back and your player mat has all of that laid out very intuitively for you. So you can just look at it. Well, almost very, fairly intuitively. It's not always clear, like, is it the one under or is it the one next to? I mean, it's obviously it's not the one under. You'd have to pick up a cube all the time. But that is the question everyone asks the first time that they play. So there's a little bit of, but for the most part, once you got the game, you have this mat in front of you with cubes as described that tell you all the information you need at a glance.
Right. To flip it around and give a bad example, an example of bad bookkeeping, there was a game we used to play like a decade and a half ago called Battle Mist, which required you, in the style of, you know, real-time strategy games on the computer, to keep track of how much lumber, iron, and wheat you had from your fantasy realm. But you kept track of that business with chips, just like, one chip of wood is one unit of wood, and you just had to dig them out of the supply pile. And you just got them from in the harvest phase, and so you had to count how many were on the board and how many that would give you, and then take and put in your pile, and then spend by returning. It was just a mess. It took forever to move, just to move resources around.
Yeah.
Then you had to count your troops and use your grain to supply them. That was bad. Eclipse does it more... I don't know if it's still frustrating if you're not into that kind of game. Though. Yeah, but it's less cumbersome to just physically move the stuff you need to move around.
Yeah.
Eclipse's math, that was math, and also fiddling with little cardboard things.
Either of those games would be worse if it was just like, remember this.
Well, yeah.
Or, you know, like, write it down on a piece of paper. That's not great.
Sure. So, but I guess the lesson there is that if you've got something that your player has to track, the more smoothly you can integrate it into things they're going to do anyway, the better off you're going to be.
Mm-hmm. We've been playing a game recently called Time and Space, which I think we reviewed.
We reviewed, and we've mentioned it a lot because we have just a lot of love for this game.
Yeah, and it does some bookkeeping anyway, that is not terribly difficult in practice.
Mm-hmm.
But the explanation of it seems difficult both. It seems difficult both to explain and for people to grasp.
Okay.
Like the difference between orders that are not yet on the board, orders that are on the board, orders that you filled.
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
You know, what can go where. And I think they did a pretty good job of making it work. But I've taught the game to several different groups of people, and there's always at least one of them who just completely misses something about how orders get on the board.
Yeah,
whatever. And it's very hard to explain because they don't give you the necessary terminology to differentiate between orders in different places.
I think in some cases that's a translation issue in that game too.
Yeah, could be.
Two, that's also an issue of the player mat doesn't have a defined space for orders in some cases. It's not put your orders in this square on your player mat. It's these orders are put them to the left of your player mat, maybe if you have space to the left of
right.
it. And then put ones that you filled under your mat. If
or
that
above
happens.
It.
Or maybe.
Or whatever.
You just have to pick a space around your mat that makes sense for the, you know, the geography of the table you're playing at. And that makes it harder to say.
Yeah.
Harder to put up. Two, time and space suffers from the fact that it's real time. So if somebody didn't get it during the rules explanation and then they don't get it during the game, like you can't stop and explain it to them.
Right.
Sans running through those timers, man.
Yeah. I always end up, when I'm the one teaching it, doing poorly on the first few plays because I feel like it was my job to teach the game. And so people who have questions and are addressing them to me, and I'm like, well, I can't just let you lose because you didn't get it the first three times.
Right.
So I'm losing time explaining to them something that they didn't get.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But once you get it going, like, the game is good.
We like Time and Space
definitely,
a lot.
Like, that is a time where bookkeeping can be an issue.
Yeah, definitely. Time and Space runs into a couple of problems there. But it's a great game. Highly recommend. Highly.
Are there any that do the bookkeeping thing, like, just spectacularly?
I'm a big fan of Eclipse's bookkeeping. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of, I don't think you played this one because we thought you would punch us in the neck if we suggested it. Terra Mystica does a good time too. Terra Mystica it's a pure economic engine-y type game, but it does a great job of whenever you take something, like at the start of the game, you put a bunch of components on your player mat, and whenever you take them off of your player mat to put them on the board or move them around, you reveal some new thing that you get to do. And so you can just look at your mat and you see, oh, the things that don't have a wooden component sitting on them are the things I can do. Cool. There's some iconography to get used to, and that's which I think is a separate issue.
Sure.
Of learning the hieroglyphics of a game. Like, if you just put text there, that would communicate the same kind of idea. But just the fact that the act of you've got both settlements and cities, mm-hmm. and if you upgrade a settlement to a city, you take the city off your board, put it where the settlement was, and put the settlement back on. So you would now just with a fairly intuitive process, oh, I'm replacing a settlement with a city. That's what I would do. You've upgraded two different tracks on your board mm-hmm. and given yourself two new pieces of information about how your whole little empire is going to run. So I like that kind of thing where you smoothly integrate updates to your income or supply necessity or whatever, whatever kind of bookkeepy resource tracky thing you have to do. You smoothly integrate that into something else you're doing to interact with the game. That's what I think makes for good bookkeeping, or easy bookkeeping at any rate. Let's see here. I feel like Arkham, I love Arkham, but it does run into some problems with this kind of thing. There's just so many little things to keep track of.
Yeah, I mean, your bookkeeping in Arkham is pretty straightforward.
It's just there's a million.
But there's like a million little tokens. Yeah. But you know, when you have the tokens, you know what they mean.
You have them, yeah.
But yeah, it's like, oh, hey, can you hand me four little cardboard dollar bills?
Right. And two, it's kind of a pain with Arkham. Like Arkham is hard to critique on that because would it really be better if you had $1 bill token and just had to keep moving it along a money track to keep track of how much money you had? I don't think it would be.
No.
Would it be better if you were moving a heart token along your hit point track? Maybe in that case, because it's a shorter track that gets used more often, but even then, I don't know, maybe Arkham's not a good one to bring up.
It's just, there's a lot of bookkeeping.
There is. It's a lot to keep track of in Arkham. Any games that do it just really badly that you've played that you're just like, really? I have to, you want me to remember what?
Well, for me, it's not even so much necessarily that there's a lot to remember. It's what you were talking about, the how well it streamlines into the game.
Mm-hmm.
So like, there's bookkeeping that happens in Dominion,
mm-hmm.
which I don't even think about. Like, you have to be aware of how many victory points you have. You can't just look at them because they're flowing through your constantly changing deck. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're in your hand, sometimes they're not. Unless you've really thought ahead, and I know most people do, more than I do, but like gold, the amount of gold I have, I could almost never tell you, or just money in general, I could almost never tell you the amount of money I have in that game in my deck. Some people play a very tight monetary game and make sure they have cards that let them move money back into their hand or whatever, so they can always have what they need to spend without filling out their hand with so much treasure, but I don't do that. But at the same time, I'm usually pretty aware of the vague idea of how much I have, not the solid numbers, but like, I know I have a fair amount going on. Like, I should have enough to buy in the majority of hands of, of a shuffled deck. And so I guess in that situation, it's so much the driving force of the game. Like, you need the gold to do the things you need to do, the things to get the victory points, which you need to win. Like, it's pretty basic. But it's streamlined into the game well enough that there's never a point where you're just like, oh, I'm having such a hard time keeping track of how much money I have or how many victory points. How many victory points do I have right now? Like, you're usually pretty aware, and other people are pretty aware, like, oh, well, you bought a duchy or you bought a whatever. Like, other people are aware of your victory points compared to theirs to a degree at least. So, which compared to, I don't know what, I pretty much avoid games that require that level of resource tracking. But if it's just like you're playing a game and you have these resources to keep track of, that's when it becomes a problem for mm-hmm. me. When the resource tracking, it's not even that it's not a resource tracking game. It's a game with resource tracking. Mm-hmm. Does that distinction make any sense?
Yeah, it's the resources don't feel like the thing you're focusing right. on. They're a thing that's greasing the wheels yeah. between the thing you're focusing
on. That's
when
I'm like, what? How many sheep? I don't care.
Mm. Kind of like, you know, Monopoly, I think, is a game that does that. Because, like, who, other than weird kids that were wearing sweater vests in the third grade, liked being the banker and having to just constantly do a crap load of math to pass out money and just...
Cheaters who wanted to be able to steal from the bank while no one was looking.
Fair enough. But you know what I mean? Like, who... Like, the worst... Monopoly is garbage, but one of the worst parts of it is just moving all of that paper money around.
Right.
It's just like, why am I doing this when the game is about building hotels and buying property? Why can't we simplify... how I do that, how I interact with that main right. thing I'm interested in doing. Why do I have to, why are we granulating this down to the $1 bill, for God's sake?
Well, I wonder if, because if Monopoly didn't exist,
uh-huh.
I might be tempted to use that as a mechanic, because if done well, the just tactile sensation of handing money around mm-hmm. could be a fun part of the game. Like, I love a game. Like the That's tokens, when there are tokens in Dominion, I love those tokens. I want them. In like, if maybe they're just worth victory points, they are worth more victory points in my heart
mm-hmm.
than a card of the same number
yeah,
of victory
points. It's more fun to pile a bunch of metal tokens yeah. on a little board than it is to get the normal, oh, I got more duchies. Yeah. But, oh, I totally agree.
So I think there, to some degree, they were going for just the tactile sensation of like handing wads of cash around.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right; it did just create a lot of.
Well, but there's an important distinction there too. The tactile sensation of using the tokens is fun and engaging, but it's also simple. It's one type of token that you pile on one board. Monopoly's got, you know, $1 bills through $500 bills that you then have to make change for and all yeah. that. You can simplify that by breaking it down only down to the $10 level or the $50 level. We're talking about property buying here. Nobody right. goes down to that level of precision when buying or selling a house.
Well, yes, the bank does, but
bank.
I see. Yes. Exactly.
Yeah, but no board game designer.
Right.
Should.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. You know what? You know people keep track of that. Cool.
Yeah.
That's fun.
I mean, yeah, where I come down is if there's bookkeeping to be done, redesign your game so there isn't.
So that
generally speaking.
Yeah, I agree. I think I'm willing to put up with I think I find engines and moving resources are more interesting than you do. So I'm willing to, I don't want to say tolerate because it sounds like it's intrinsically a bad thing.
Right.
But I'm willing to engage with it more.
Well, I think, you just like it more than
yeah,
I do. That's
yeah.
fine.
But I do agree that you want it to smoothly integrate with everything else you're doing.
Yeah.
Like, you want, if we're making a game about, you know, buying and selling herds of cattle on the plains of the Old West,
mm-hmm.
when I buy a cow, I want whatever I have to do to make that cow part of my herd to also, in the same action, without having to do anything else, tell me how much my herd is worth.
Right. Tell you what the benefit is of yeah. having added that cow.
In one, without having to move an extra token or grab an extra card or anything
right.
like that. Like, don't make me do more than one thing to update my player state.
Right.
And if you do, you better have a good reason for doing it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's kind of the takeaway we've got here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did we come down like on almost the same side of an issue?
I guess.
Are we like a team?
We're a team. A space team.
I love that game.
The game's pretty great.
If you haven't played it, go download Space Team on your mobile device of choice and find some friends to play it with you. You will not regret it. It's great. We'll put a link in the show notes.
Which we've done before, but I'll do it again.
Have we done that before?
Yeah, we've mentioned it. It's pretty great. We call it the Shouty Space Game.
Shouty.
Because you're in space and you're shouting.
And it's a game.
Yeah, that pretty much covers it.
Yep, those are all the things.
Well, if you're in space, you should let us know. On Twitter at Mildly Alarming.
On email at mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com.
On the website at www.mildlyalarming.com or on facebook.com/mildlyalarmingshow. You can also find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and TuneIn Radio, where in most of those places, you could leave a review and also write something which we would read.
Or you could fire off your space thrusters across the sky while also performing a Kelvin maneuver, which sends a burning stream of plasma behind your craft and spell it out in the sky above our heads, because then we'd be able to see it.
As long as you're facing the right way, or like, you know, in relation to... Listen, like, there's certain ways they could skywrite it out in space where we'd just see, like, a dot or nothing, or it would be backwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you should do it right, though.
Figure out the logistics so we can read it.
Yeah, we'd appreciate that.
Thanks.
Good night.
See you next week.
Yay, yay! Hello, listeners. I'm Jerry Dudio, and I spent a bunch of money to buy ad space on this podcast strictly to say the word tiddlywinks. So, here goes. Tiddlywinks. Thank you.